Speaking next, I'm pleased to see Amanda Lugg speaking on behalf of ACT UP. As you may know, some of our first brothers and sisters and comrades out on the street to be arrested were in fact from ACT UP. I believe it was seven people.
Yeah.
Seven people yesterday. They've opened up the Navy Yard out in Brooklyn. So just, you know, get out there tomorrow, the next day, in the next few days, and show your support, and show your support right now for Amanda Lugg. And I'd also like to add, we've got some great speakers coming up following this. Jaggi Singh is speaking last. We have Cindy Milstein coming up, and Ricardo Juarez. So stick around, and there should be a performance by Art and Revolution after. Thank you.
My name's Amanda Lugg. I'm with ACT UP New York. I also work at African Services Committee. It's a local NGO based in Harlem that provides health, legal, and supportive services to the African immigrant community here in New York City. Donate the dollars, treat the people, and cancel the debt. I've been asked to talk about public health solutions that can or should be implemented to solve the global AIDS crisis. If we donate the dollars, we treat the people, we cancel the debt, we do stand a real chance of winning the war on global AIDS. I'm here to share with you today not only the god-awful effect that the World Economic Forum is having on this war, but also what public health solutions are already in place and what solutions should and can be implemented to halt the spread of this disease and assist the already 36 million people around the world who are living with HIV/AIDS. If I could just start with some stats. According to UNAIDS, there are now 36 million people worldwide infected with HIV/AIDS. 95% of these people are living in developing countries. Sub-Saharan Africa alone is home to over 25 million infected men, women, and children. This is about 70% of the world's cases. UNAIDS reports that AIDS is spreading at an alarming rate in the Caribbean, Eastern Europe, and Asia. Asia, which is now home to almost 6 million infected people, and the number's still growing. AIDS has now claimed an estimated 17 million Africans, with one African dying every single second of every single day. Some 12 million children are AIDS orphans, and if we don't grab a hold of this, the global number of AIDS orphans may reach 40 million by the year 2010. Around the world, there are 15,000 new HIV infections every day and 8,000 AIDS deaths. 8,000 people dying around the world every day. So what do? We can donate the dollars. Successful and proven programs in prevention, treatment, and support do exist, but they're small and starved of resources. According to UNAIDS, stated repeatedly by Kofi Annan, the UN Secretary General, at least $10 billion is needed annually to fuel a serious response to the AIDS pandemic in the form of the Global AIDS, TB, and Malaria Fund. Sounds like a lot of money, until you consider some of the facts, such as the fact that $10 billion is less than 1% of the world's annual military spending budget. With the pathetic announcement by the President this week that the US, the world's richest nation, will be donating a mere $200 million to the Global Fund this year, when in fact in November even Republicans in the House of Representatives authorized $750 million, our President asked for $48 billion in additional military spending. So what are we saying here? We can afford to take lives, but no, we can't afford to save them. Way to go, Mr. President. We must continue lobbying for more major dollars for the Global Fund. Write or call your representatives, call Schumer, call the White House every bloody day. If the US would appropriate major dollars for global treatment access, this would drive the development of pharmaceutical production facilities in countries like China and India. Imagine a global drug store. This in turn would lead to production of cheaper antiretrovirals, which developing countries will then be able to afford. We can treat the people. The World Health Organization estimates that 5 to 6 million Africans living with HIV/AIDS are in need of treatment with antiretroviral medications. Mainly due to price and the World Trade Organization's patent system, those meds are out of reach. These life-saving medications can be provided in countries with limited infrastructure, but these countries need to be able to purchase drugs at affordable prices and be able to import or produce generic drugs. As I mentioned, there are proven examples. Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, or Doctors Without Borders, they run three clinics just outside of Cape Town. The project's part of an agreement between MSF and the government of the Western Cape, signed 2 years ago to test the feasibility of antiretroviral therapy. Offering a comprehensive package of services since April of 2000, they provided treatment for opportunistic infections for over 2,000 people living with HIV/AIDS. In May of last year, combination antiretroviral therapy began for people in advanced stages of AIDS. To date, 85 people have received antiretroviral therapy, 50 of whom are receiving meds from Brazil. Brazil, which makes their own generic drugs. Using generics obviously offers the possibility of treating twice the amount of people for the same amount of money. And cancelling the debt. We can cancel the debt. We call on the World Bank, the IMF, to cancel 100% of the debt owed to them by all impoverished countries heavily impacted by HIV/AIDS. Sub-Saharan African countries combined pay back over $300 million a week in odious debt repayments to the IMF and World Bank. $300 million a week. This is hard cash that can be turned around and devoted to healthcare and education. The limited debt already provided to some countries has saved them a total of almost $1 billion in debt repayments. As a result of this debt relief, several countries have stepped up spending on AIDS programs. In Uganda, where due to prevention and education programs, the infection rate in urban areas has been reduced from a high of 30% in 1992 down to 10% in 2000. New monies must be made available as grants, not as World Bank loans. Debt relief must also be broadened to more developing countries. And so to the multinationals, to those bastions of capitalism and corporate greed, how exactly are they assisting us? At the last World Economic Forum in Switzerland, heads of state and business execs created the Global Health Initiative. In an attempt to whitewash corporate dominization and globalization, this week, the Global Health Initiative will release their report on the business sector's response to HIV/AIDS and malaria in developing countries. While multinational corporations are starting to recognize the impact of the pandemic on their workforce and therefore their bottom line, most corporations are doing little more than counting their dead. Some multinationals have put in place essential non-discriminatory policies towards people living with HIV, and some have workplace programs that provide condoms and education about prevention. However, almost all are falling short of their real responsibilities. Take a look at Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola, for example, is the poster child of the business community at the moment because they've offered to carry prevention messages, pamphlets, and condoms on their trucks. Coke is the largest private employer on the continent of Africa, employing approximately 100,000 people directly and indirectly. In a brilliant publicity stunt last year, Coke said that it would offer antiretroviral medications to its HIV/AIDS-infected employees. However, what they've done is to offer antiretrovirals to only 1,600 people. Now they say that they only employ 1,600 people in Africa. This, of course, excludes all their franchises and the far larger group of workers that work in the bottling factories. Another example is Anglo American. Anglo American is a large mining concern in sub-Saharan Africa, which employs 60,000 workers. Recently, they reversed an earlier announcement by claiming that they can't afford to supply antiretroviral drugs to all its HIV-infected workers, and instead just 14,000 senior staff will receive treatment. The provision of drug treatment for lower-income employees was deemed too expensive. AIDS is expected to slash overall economic activity in Africa by one quarter, and the company said that it could lose 20% of its South African workforce to AIDS. South Africa's National Union of Mine Workers accused Anglo-American of putting profits before people, and on the eve of World AIDS Day last year, they marched on coal mines in South Africa demanding treatment. There has been a global movement in place for almost 4 years now of US and Global South activists working together in solidarity, fighting for the right to health care and the primacy of public health over profits. In the last 6 months alone, there have been major protests of people with AIDS and their advocates demanding AIDS drugs in China, Thailand, South Africa, South Korea, Ethiopia, Nigeria, Uganda, Kenya, Brazil, India, and Côte d'Ivoire. ACT UP, Health Gap, and our international allies are launching an international campaign. This campaign will force multinational corporations to provide AIDS treatment inclusive of antiretrovirals to their affected and infected employees and their families. No different at all to the employee benefits that they readily support in developed countries. Their practices in the Global South are blatant medical apartheid. I ask you to join ACT UP New York and to work with us on this campaign and to join us in protesting at the World Economic Forum tomorrow. Thank you.
Speaking next is the founder of the Institute for Anarchist Studies. You're not the founder? Oh, I'm sorry. Well, a member of the Institute for Anarchist Studies, I suppose, and also the Institute for Social Ecology and a columnist for Arsenal Magazine. I'm not wrong about that, am I? And an author and activist, Cindy Milstein.
The title of this panel is called, part of it is called Globalizing Justice, and I think that's totally necessary and totally important, but I don't think it's sufficient. So I also want to talk about what it means to globalize freedom. And what I want to do right now is, what I think globalization is largely about is a fundamental transformation in power relationships globally. And I think we're still in the midst of a dramatic upheaval and a contest of who's going to shape and control the world. And I think it's an open question, which is why there's been such a vibrant movement around the globe to resist capitalism. At the same time, there's been new forms of policing to contest that. Nation states, international agencies, NGOs, politicized fundamentalists, radicals, etc., we have all been vying as actors in this contest to reshape and reclaim in different ways what power might look like in a globalized world. And I think this is where the fight is right now, a fight over fundamentally who is going to shape the world. Yes, I think another world is possible from today. And not only possible, but probable. The question is, what kind of world is that going to be? What kind of world and who's going to shape it? Who's going to get to decide what that world looks like? And who's ultimately going to continue to either rule or determine what that world looks like over time? Who will get to make the social, economic, cultural, and political decisions about what this new global world looks like? And I think this is really a contest between authoritarian forms of decision-making and anti-authoritarian forms of decision-making, which is why I think this current movement has been so powerful in advocating an anti-authoritarian understanding of decision-making. I know we've all heard a lot about the WEF, and that's why we're here, but I want to point out one thing that I think is interesting about what's happening with the WEF. To me, they are forging, what's scariest about them is I think it is forging a new model of an extremely dangerous form of authoritarianism. And that's what I want to look at really briefly, the organizational form that I think we're facing, which is new. And obviously, I hope we're going to contest this form of decision making. I think that WEF is a lean, mobile, and it is actually an NGO that is able to, it itself says that it has no political, partisan, or national ties. It is completely outside the normal systems we understand that make power. It is a cooperative club atmosphere of people networking together, where people come together that really are, and I hate to use the term best of, but really they are the foremost sort of far-reaching thinkers in capitalism, the economy, but not just that, in media, in academia, in labor, in NGOs. These are people who are, in a sense, more visionary than even nation states, I think, right now. And they think in this kind of networking, cooperative club environment, they can hang out, drink together, get to know each other, and discuss what the global agenda is going to look like. But not just economic concerns, but social, political concerns, what this new world will look like. And they actually believe that they can, if you look at their website, they say we plan to mold solutions and ultimately implement them. And since they are the most sort of cutting edge, influential, wealthy people, they actually can do that. They have the infrastructure. Bill Gates is such a great example. I hate to point to individuals because I think it's more of an institutional system, not just one individual. But Bill Gates not only has determined how we as a global society communicate, he's now determining health policies for whole continents. And I don't think anyone should have that kind of power to determine, you know, for good or bad. I don't think one person should be able for a whole continent to determine the health policy, which is what he's trying to do now. So what we have with the WEF forming, which I think is totally scary and dangerous, is a completely unaccountable, supranational, even super-international, outside of nation states, outside of UNs and things like that, free-floating institution that's not embedded in a place, a space, a new form of non-governmental governance that has no ability, even it almost makes nation states look good. It's so far removed from any sense of any even knowing where it is. And what's really scary about the WEF to me is they understand that they are contending to rule the world, and they advocate corporate citizenry, where the citizenry is about 1,000 people who also are the rulers. And that's a really scary model of what governance and power will look like in the future. So I think the reason they've come to New York is not only to get away from the incredible resistance that's happened in Davos, not only to try to discredit us here in the wake of September 11th and say, well, look, who are they to be protesting after September 11th? Not only to rebuild the New York economy, supposedly, but I think they've come here to say, we are the new face of power. The New York Stock Exchange was shut down by September 11th, but you can't shut us down because we're everywhere. We aren't in a fixed place. We're even more mobile and agile and far thinking than the United States. We are the new global heirs to what power is going to look like, and that's damn scary, I think. So I want to contest this briefly to the World Social Forum. That's another alternative that's pointed out. And I think, yes, the World Social Forum does good things, and it's much more socially minded. But I really want to talk about its institutional structure for a minute, because I think it inadvertently or advertently actually mirrors the same kind of organizational structure of a very top-down, unaccountable, supranational entity making decisions. Yes, it's socially concerned. Yes, it will ameliorate suffering. Yes, it's doing good work. But I still think what the World Social Forum is calling for, even though it's a heightened level of participation, it's still about a group meeting in a very similar cooperative networking atmosphere at a very top-heavy global place to discuss what the world will look like. And even though it's for socially concerned reasons, I still think a small group of people shouldn't be determining that. The other thing I think is problematic about this structure is, like the World Economic Forum, members of government come to the World Social Forum. This year, they're actually in Porto Alegre, Brazil. They also have a forum of local authorities. That sounds scary as hell to me. And it's the mayors of some of the biggest cities that are coming together to find out how to make their cities more participatory. They also have a forum of world parliamentarians. These are the same representatives of people from countries that are also going to the World Economic Forum. And while the World Social Forum is doing good, I think the model is to try to make capitalism a little nicer, a little more caring, and not recognizing that an exploitative system, no matter how nice, is still exploitation. It's trying to make government kinder and gentler, but a system of governance that is coercive is never going to be that nice, no matter how it does coercion. So ultimately, I think the problem with the World Economic Forum is it pulls together the most influential NGOs, the most influential movement leaders, the most influential kind of nice government representatives, and it too tries to shape the globalist agenda, far removed from most of our daily lives, most of what we want on the grassroots level. So I think we need to say that participation, heightened levels of participation, as they advocate, is not enough. Giving us more of a voice or more of an input is not enough. We need power on the grassroots level. We need to contest models of really remove power with what a grassroots power would look like. Not coincidentally, perhaps, the World Social Forum advocates planetary citizenship, which I also find extremely scary. I don't want to have to suddenly vote on the planetary level, and who is that planetary government that I'm voting for? I still think it just replicates the same mindset, albeit doing much better work than the World Economic Forum. But it's still decisions by the few. And I want to counterpose this to saying that what I think we're asking for is not a better piece of the pie, a little bit more justice, but we want to determine the flavor, the quality, the shape, the content of that pie. We want to change the parameters of who even gets to determine how we make that pie in the first place. So the World Social Forum model or the World Economic Forum both ignore systems of domination such as capitalism, states, racism, and we could think of a host of other forms of domination, and the need for fundamental social transformation if we want to root out domination. It ignores the question of freedom and the need for fundamental social reconstruction if we want to shape our worlds together. So what's the alternative? Other alternative, the anti-authoritarian alternative? And I'm going to just do two brief things here to wrap up. One is what's been happening on the streets and what's going to happen hopefully tomorrow. An anti-capitalist, anti-authoritarian movement that is trying to organize and speak for the kind of world it wants to see right now. This is much more necessary but still not sufficient, I think. It's trying to show that there's grassroots resistance and shatter a sense of consensus. I think, I hope everyone shows up at all the rallies, especially the legal rallies tomorrow. I hope there's tens of thousands of people on the street tomorrow, simply to shatter the fact that there's some kind of unity or consensus going on right now. But more than that, it starts to reclaim the world in the way we want to see the world. And it starts to build infrastructure. You know, what would replace how we feed each other? What would replace the forms of healthcare we don't like? Speaking about AIDS so eloquently, what would be a humane and wonderful way to be able to deal with people's health needs? And we start doing that on the street through our medical folks that do that, through the people who provide food for free instead of for profit, through the people who are doing independent media. We start to model a kind of anti-authoritarian structures of doing these things. And temporarily, we start to reclaim power by liberating spaces that we're told aren't ours. And that's why I think these demonstrations are amazing for those of us that go to them, because suddenly you feel extraordinary sense of control over your life. Of all of us together, in a wonderful diversity of tactics, being able to shape what we want our cities to look like together. And it's so brief and so fleeting, and you go home and life seems dull by comparison, because there's so few moments in our life when we get to shape what our world might look like. But I think we should do that every day. So for me, the real alternative, wait till the police go by, the real alternative is we have to start thinking about what is the highest form of direct action. Because for me, direct action is when we start saying, no, we can do that in a different way that's about mutual aid, cooperation, egalitarianism, hopefully all the libertarian values that many of us on the anti-authoritarian left hold. Direct action is about reclaiming those things outside the structures that don't let us do food the way we want to do that. But to me, the highest form of direct action is when every day, all of us together can continually shape what our lives look like. That the highest form of direct action would be confederal forms of direct democracy, where we're taking power back and we're not going to let the state give us or take away civil liberties, give us or take away abortion, give us or take away war versus peacetime. We're not going to demand things from those structures. We're going to determine what we want to do with our world. We're going to determine what we understand our liberties to be together. So for me, what would be, I want to end on this note that I think, interestingly, about the World Economic Forum, I think it's really intriguing to take words seriously of what these organizations are trying to do. And the World Economic Forum, I think, more than any other organization, really understands what's happening in the world right now. I encourage people to go home and look at their website, because they really have been in the forefront of understanding where the world's going. And obviously, not the way we want it to go. But this year, their theme is leadership in fragile times. And I think these are horribly fragile times. People feel vulnerable, insecure, more out of control of their lives than probably ever before. But what the NGO says is, World Economic Forum says is the solution for feeling fragile is they want to make the world safe for capitalism, safe for new forms of domination, safe for those that already have power so they can continue to hang on to their power and consolidate it even tighter. I think we need to ask, what would a safe and secure world look like that's anti-authoritarian, that's anti-capitalist, that opposes all forms of oppression? What would it make be to have a secure world where people know that food isn't dependent on whether you have money or not? whether healthcare isn't dependent on whether what you have money or not, where we decide together what we want these things to be, and where we decide them together in liberatory, directly democratic, and federal fashion. I think we should start self-determining now, all of us together. I think we should start self-governing now. I think we should start confederating with each other for mutual aid and solidarity and support on the global level. I don't want to return to counterpose globalization to localism. I think we need to retain our sense of global solidarity and link that back to where we live. I think we need to say what we need are community social forms, neighborhood social forms. We need to be able to come together in our communities and shape the agenda for what we want the world to look like. And not just shape the agenda, but implement it. Do it ourselves where we live together and form networks of solidarity with other people to be able to implement that. So I'm going to end on kind of I think these are extremely bleak times. And we face not only the old forms of authoritarianism, imperialism, colonialism, the United States as global police, et cetera, but increasingly we face new forms of authoritarianism, which potentially could make the old forms of authoritarianism almost look nice by comparison. So it's very bleak times. But at the same time, I think we've been amazing at counterposing that with a vision of what anti-authoritarianism would look like in a world. That we've been starting to prefigure that now in how both we supply people's material needs, which is totally important. People can't struggle for freedom unless they have enough to eat. But we've also been able to start saying, what would it look like to fulfill our desires and our potentialities? And that's when freedom starts to emerge. So at worst, I think we'll leave a legacy for future radicals of a libertarian, confederal forms, anti-authoritarian forms of making decisions as a way of making social decisions together. We'll leave a legacy of anti-capitalist, anti-authoritarian, struggling for a better world in a better way. And at best, I think we'll begin to start right now to build dual power centers to not only contest, but ultimately replace capitalism, nation states, world economic forms, and world social forms, all those things that want to put power and control of our lives outside of our all of our abilities to make decisions. And maybe, just maybe, we can start to make real the slogan that's been really powerful on the left, all power to the people, where the people doesn't mean just a few of us, no matter how nice we are. It means all of us. And where power isn't used to exploit, coerce, oppress, dominate other people. Power is used to create a society where all of us get a sense in shaping a world that fulfills who we want to be as people, that fulfills ourselves as free individuals in a free society, where power is not a coercive act, it's a way to create the world we want to see. That's how I think we begin to globalize not just justice, but freedom.
Our next speaker is a construction worker from D.C. who was recommended to us on behalf of the EZLN, the Zapatista Army of National Liberation. He is a member of El Comité Zapatista de los Pasamontas, the Zapatista Ski Mask Support Committee, and also the Mexico Solidarity Network. His name is Ricardo Juarez.
Hi, everybody. I have a Zapatista greeting for all yours. I would like to ask something. Are you sure that another war is possible?
Yeah.
I think that can be possible in peace and love. In the indigenous communities in Mexico, in Chiapas, where they have a meeting together, when they are waiting for somebody from another place, they receive the people with a greeting. So, like Zapatista, let me give a greeting for all yours. Well, I think so. When I am in the way to this place, I see a lot of police. I think everybody can agree with me. New York is under with a cordon of police. Is in around a police circle around the city. That made me think in another situations like that. So in this case, the people who come to the economic forum are in the middle. We are around, and the police are around us. So that is not a particular case in New York. That's happening, and that is the face of the neoliberalism around the world. You can remember in the economic crisis in Mexico some years ago, they have some similitudes with another situations like in Argentina and USA. Long time ago in Mexico, the political class is giving all their support to make more easy the way to the rich people to be more rich. In Argentina, that thing is the same thing. The people with the money, like criminal bands, take the money from the banks, and a lot of cars take the money to the airport and take the money to USA, Suiza, and other places. And they leave Argentina without money, with all the money with the workers' people. In USA, in Iran, it's the same thing. In Iran, take the money for the workers, for the American society, by support the political class, the people who are now in the White House, with the support, with the privacy security group, it's called the Pentagon. So if we think about that four pictures, all that is the same thing, and now we can see this picture in New York. 8 years ago, the rich people in Mexico, the political class, they are celebrating the enter on the new world, the free trade of the Americas with Canada and USA. And then one night, some indigenous people, the poor, come into the night with a ski mask, with some guns, and they're oppressing, unmasking the real system in Mexico. From January 1st, on 94, the ECLN in Mexico was resisting the prosecution, the militaries, the war against the communities. And we have to understand why it's very important the ECLN survive, because all that kind of trades are under the interest of the rich people and under the geopolitical interest of the USA. Before and then, the Mexican governments are having agreements behind the public opinion with the USA government, and the ESLN is a very hard stone on their way to install in Mexico the neoliberalist projects, something like the Plan Puebla Panama. So that is like a horse, a Trojan horse, for making more easy the way for installing in Latin America the FTAA. We, like Zapatistas, we understand all the war against the Zapatistas is under the global geopolitical and military strategic of the USA. Now they are making the war in Asia against Afghanistan. They are doing another kind of war against the people who is resisting the neoliberalism in Latin America, like the ESLN. This is a different kind of wars. All the way around the world, some groups are resisting and need the solidarity from another people on the world, people like you. The ESLN need the solidarity of the world too. If we are working together in this way against that, I ask you for the support. Please never forget the ECLN is there. I want to talk a little bit about Argentina, because some kind of winds is flowing from the south. In Mexico is this ECLN, in Central America and other groups. And in the South America, some people call it Argentinos. They are very stronger now. They take the streets. And they take some very important words. They take the word people, human, and community. The force of the neoliberalism have the armies, have a lot of money, have a lot of political people on the governments of some countries. But I think the humans are more strong than that. We are thinking in Argentina really don't broke the neoliberalism system. Argentina was like a big store, like a luxury shell. In Argentina, happened something like a electric short. This rebellion in Argentina is inviting us, like the ESLN in their time, to think about of the life and the future, but outside of the mark of the of this system. Really, I think this millennium don't start the September 11, like a lot of people like to say. I think this millennium start on Genoa, Italy, and from Genoa to Buenos Aires, Argentina, they are our cities. We are the people. This is the history. Yeah, the ECLN experience in Mexico, the Argentinian experience are pushing us to think about that new life. I think about the society of the equals, the society of the freedom people. The new project for the society, I think, really coming mixed with justice, social justice, the reappropriation of the nature. The cultural and ethnic demands, the local power, the decentralization of the power, the humanization of the technology. I mean the social participation, like the vertebral spine of the new world. In three terms, we have to take a look on the future, if it's possible to take some collective control of the state, the democratization of the lands, and pour into the agenda the environmental struggle. Well, I just have two more couple minutes, and just I wanna invite you to never forget that of poor people from Chiapas and from Argentina, because the base of their culture is the community. Maybe we can start with that to build a new world. That was the Zapatistas are thinking. So that's what I want to share with you. I think it's very important to understand the new world don't gonna come for the people who are in the banks. The new globalizations, the good one, is gonna come from the bottom, gonna come from the communities, from you. So we have to take the way through on that. I invite you to follow in building the international of the hopes, and never stop on that. I'm sorry. I'm a construction worker. I am a Zapatista, and I don't know if that's plenty, but the Zapatistas talk with the word of the heart, and the Zapatistas are feeling strong when we feel with people like you. Okay.
For our final speaker, we have Jagi Singh. We are very pleased to have him down from Montreal, as the border police is not always friendly to well-known anarchists. But he is an activist and a writer. He works with CLAC, which is Montreal's anti-capitalist convergence. So please give him a warm welcome. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for everyone staying towards the end, to the end. First of all, I want to thank the organizers of this counter-summit, all the individuals who put this together. Despite the pressure and fear-mongering of the NYPD and the media, they stayed true to their principles and they hung in there, and I think they deserve to be commended. I also want to thank someone here coming from Montreal. I want to thank all the New Yorkers from the Another World is Possible Coalition, from the Anti-Capitalist Convergence, from Students for Global Justice, for making this call out to mobilize and oppose the World Economic Forum. In Quebec City, when we were opposing the free trade of the Americas, we said it didn't start in Seattle, it's not going to stop in Quebec City. You proved us right, but there's something more important than that. You're confronting the disgusting cynicism of the WEF and their decision to move their meeting of the super rich here to New York City as some show of solidarity with the pain that people in New York suffered, as if it's only the corporate and capitalist class that can show proper solidarity. And we get an idea of their solidarity with them having a big party, a cocktail party at the stock exchange. As if New Yorkers of a variety of backgrounds, including people involved with these various coalitions, including the black people of the city, the brown people of the city, and the yellow people of the city, as if all those people don't feel the same pain and tragedy of the collapse of the Twin Towers. As if we're not all capable of showing our own solidarity based on our own values of social justice, where I think true solidarity comes from. So I want to thank you, people from the AWIP Coalition, from ACC, from Students for Global Justice, for not giving into that cynicism and for taking the courageous step to facilitate and organize the resistance here in New York City. I also want to thank the people who are working day-to-day here in New York, people like Mon Ami and the Sisters and Brothers in Drum, people like Amanda and the Sisters and Brothers in ACT UP, people here in New York who are fighting every day against poverty, against police brutality, against prisons, against the whole prison industrial complex. We can talk all we want about globalizing solidarity and justice, but I think the best way to globalize our solidarity and justice is to show that solidarity with those activists here in New York who are kicking ass every day. I don't want to mince words, and I want to try to cut through a lot of the crap about the World Economic Forum, about the anti-globalization movement, about strategies and tactics. One of the critiques that are put out about us are that we don't know exactly what we're opposing, that we're just knee-jerk protesters. Well, we spent the last 2 days at this counter summit talking about some of our arguments and sharing our resistance and stories of resistance. But I think fundamentally, it's a clash of visions we're talking about, not a clash of civilizations, because I don't think there's really anything civilized about capitalist domination, but a clash of visions. We get this whole alphabet soup, WEF, IMF, World Bank, FTAA, WTO, NAFTA, but I all think they, at heart, fundamentally show the same vision, a vision that doesn't talk about human beings, but rather capital, doesn't talk about ecosystems, but rather resources, doesn't talk about culture, but rather commodities. It's a monoculture, a culture that I like to say it looks like Disney, it tastes like Coke, but it smells like shit. I don't think watching the rich get filthy rich and hoping that some of that is going to trickle down to the rest of us is any humane vision of the world. And of course, we have to assert our own positive vision of freedom, of social and economic justice, of mutual aid, of solidarity, of true and direct democracy. And we don't have it all worked out. But I think we sure as hell have to oppose exploitation and oppression in whatever form we find it. Another part of cutting through the crap is exposing the World Economic Forum. It's presented as somehow some cultural gathering, dealing with very, you know, important issues. And, you know, the Bonos and the Desmond Tutus are selectively used to sort of cover, as cover, to hide what is essentially the annual general meeting of global capitalism. You pay $25,000 to attend by invitation. 1,000 of the world's largest corporations. It's a big cocktail party, a networking session. And it's just as insidious as the WTO, as the IMF, as the World Bank, because it's here where the future schemes for private profit and at the public expense are launched. It's kind of ironic that Enron Corporation, which has been a mainstay of the World Economic Forum, has been dropped now from the list of invitees because they went bankrupt. And Ken Lay, who was the CEO of Enron, has been disinvited. It's ironic because one way of looking at the World Economic Forum is that it's essentially a meeting of 3,000 Ken Lays. The only difference is they're getting away with it. We can't ignore the climate that we're in, the post-September 11th climate, the fact that New York City suffered a terrorist attack. And many people argue that we need to retreat or we need to reflect. Well, I don't think we need to retreat. I do think we need to reflect. But I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can reflect and we can engage in action. We can't surrender the political terrain to jingoists and chauvinists and apologists for oppression. And it's exactly in climates like this that we need to assert our space. It was inexcusable that on September 29th, certain groups canceled protests when it was a singular opportunity to publicize dissent in this country against war. And I'm glad people here are taking to the streets and not giving into that cynicism. But we also have to have a certain quality to our message. I don't think it's enough to talk about peace. I don't think it's enough to just be anti-war. All I'm saying is not just give peace a chance. September 10th was no peace. When bombs stopped dropping, that doesn't mean we have peace. War is still waged by other means, as we've seen in Iraq. I think, of course, as many others have said, we're talking about peace with justice. I think it's misleading when we talk about hawks versus doves. Hawks are people who are apologists for war, and doves are people who don't like war. Because I think on a lot of levels, we're hawks. When it comes to fighting poverty, when it comes to fighting racism, we should be hawks. I think talking about justice also means talking about imperialism, and particularly American imperialism. And to talk about American imperialism is, first of all, not to belittle the tragedy that occurred in this city. It's not to justify what happened. But rather, it's to understand, first of all, the systematic and structural ways in which both oppression and exploitation are wreaked on other people. And secondly, to expose the extraordinary hypocrisy of the CIA, the State Department, the White House, the U.S. Armed Forces, to talk about fighting terrorism. Colin Powell said, when the bombs started dropping on Kandahar and Kabul, he said, talking to Iraq and the Taliban and all the other people who are part of the evil axis, you cannot separate your activities from the activities of the perpetrators. That's what he said. And he's right. But let's apply that consistently. There's a town in Georgia called Fort Benning. They operate something called the School of the Americas. It's changed its name. It's now called the Western Hemispheric Cooperation Council. But essentially, over the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, all kinds of officers from El Salvador, from Nicaragua, from all over Central and South America came and got trained at the School of the Americas by the U.S. Armed Forces. And they went back to their countries. And many of them, the majority of them, were involved in terror and torture and in massacres. So yes, you cannot separate your activities from the activities of the perpetrators, Colin Powell. To talk about imperialism, to talk about capitalism, to talk about oppression, to do so is not, I'm not doing this to sound radical, to be holier than thou, but because I think it's strategic and it's meaningful. It's meaningful to understand what's happening in the world today. It gets to the roots of the problems, and it's a reality understood by people who are suffering through oppression. So let's not be afraid to assert the fact that we are anti-capitalist and we are anti-imperialist and we're opposed to racism and we're opposed to patriarchy. It's the starting point from which we have to fight. Of course, we should talk about what we're for, but we can do it at the same time as we talk about what we're against. I want to talk a bit about the so-called anti-globalization movement. It's been mentioned. It's the slogan we used in Quebec City. It didn't start in Seattle. And what we mean is there are roots to our resistance, roots that go back 500 years, as Mon Ami was talking about, roots that go back to anti-colonial struggles. It probably started in Chiapas in 1994 when the Zapatistas rose up against the North American Free Trade Agreement. I think talking about it didn't start in Seattle also means acknowledging the fact that there are other movements fighting day to day in probably less sensational situations for native sovereignty, against poverty, against the prison industrial complex, for the rights of immigrants and refugees. It's important to acknowledge that. I think we need to have an analysis that talks about imperialism and capitalism and that we don't use what I call weasel words, like corporate. We can't separate the corporation from the state as if the corporation is at odds with the state. The corporation and state go hand in hand. I think we need to critique reformism and lobbying. And that's not to say that I'm opposed to reforms, but I think we need to see reforms in the way that Lorenzo Kamboa Irvin, a former Black Panther, put it. Survival pending revolution. It's always been the threat of rebellion and revolt that has resulted in genuine reforms. I want to talk about another issue, and that's the issue of violence and the potential for violence in New York City. Now, let's not kid ourselves. There are some very violent people that have come to New York, and they're organized, and they're very well motivated. And those violent people are the politicians and the CEOs that are attending the World Economic Forum at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel right now. Structural adjustment programs are violence. The displacement of indigenous peoples, that's violence. 2 million people, disproportionately black and people of color, in prison, that's violence. And what we're doing on the streets of New York City is protesting against that violence and protesting against terrorism, whether it's in the name of a religion or whether it's in the name of an ideology that's called capitalism. I think we need to stand in solidarity with the full scope of resistance in the world. The full scope of resistance, which is done day to day, as I said, when people go to visit people in INS prisons, when people are lobbying for an end to the debt and for cheap drugs for AIDS. But I want to talk about one example. It's already been mentioned by Ricardo, and that's the example of Argentina. Now, I'm an anarchist, and you know I'm not really into states, but I think one thing we should be chanting on the streets tomorrow is Argentina, Argentina, Argentina. And it's not because Maradona is my favorite soccer player or anything like that. It's because what's happening in Argentina right now is it's making the people in the World Economic Forum, is making them really scared. Because what they're showing on the streets of Argentina is that in the face of oppression and exploitation, we have the right to revolt and we have the right to rebel. I want to conclude. I think in many ways the nature of oppression in the world determines the nature of opposition, and we have to name those oppressions. They've been talked about. I also think the nature of opposition determines the nature of oppression in many ways by what we're willing to accept, by minimizing the fact that there are class interests in society. Again, we need to talk about solidarity, and not solidarity as a, you know, a nice soundbite or a photo op, but standing side by side with struggles all over the world and recognizing that we can't be free until we're all free. I've talked about many reasons about why we should be on the streets, why we should be protesting, why we should care. Political reasons, strategic reasons, ethical and moral reasons. Well, I want to give another reason, and it's a reason that's probably unique to our situation right now. There are people who are saying that we should be quiet, we shouldn't be on the streets. Well, another reason is that we should be on the streets. Another reason that we should be loud is this is New York City. This is not a city that anyone can claim for themselves. This is a city of immigrants, whether illegal or illegal. It's a city where people speak their mind. I don't think we should be hesitant about this. People are speaking their mind all the time on subways, on streets, on workplaces, despite Giuliani-style fascism. We should be festive, we should be creative, we should be angry, and we should be loud. So to conclude, this is fucking New York City, and when we take to the streets, let's not be shy. Thank you.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.